So before I do, I'll make a couple of comments about the book list as far as family is concerned. I've already mentioned this one, How to Really Love Your Child. If ever there is a book which is simple, easy to read, clear, and it hits home about every page, and it actually teaches you more about how to show unconditional love than any book I've come across, it's this book. That's what I said. If you only have one book to buy, buy that one. It talks about unconditional love in marriage. It's only a few pages, but it's tremendously spot on about our basic needs. And it really gets down to practical suggestions as to what to do. Now, we'll talk about that in a little while. But number one. Now, this other book called Parents in Pain is, I think, a tremendous book, which I discovered a couple of years ago. If any of you are aching because of your children, this is a must. In fact, it's one that I say to myself, I must read at least every 6 months. Now, if you're not much of a reader, or if your children are small, or if they're not in dire straits at the moment, you might read chapter one, as I did when I looked it up in the bookshop, and it was about policemen coming to the house and so forth, and I thought, oh, this isn't really for me, not yet anyway. This isn't my book. And then someone, I had to read it because someone wanted an opinion on it once that I got into it. And I found that there are several chapters that are just marvellous for any parent with children of any age. And so if you'd like, just jot down the special chapters that are so very good. Chapter 2, this is Parents in Pain by John White. Chapter 2, Chapter 3, Chapter 5, Chapter 9, Chapter 10. Chapter 11, and I didn't finish reading it a second time, so I'm not sure about the last three as to how good they are. I think they are, actually. But they're tremendous. They're something which will nourish your spiritual life, you know, kids or not. But if you're really serious about bringing up your children and having help, and don't somehow try and get to borrow, beg or steal either of these two books, again, you're being a bit irresponsible. Maybe you can, use them for a study group if you're not a reader. Do it with somebody. Do it with a friend. Study it together. That becomes a really sharing, tremendously upbuilding time. You're building up relationships as well as learning about your kids. And they're just soaked with the scriptures, both of them. Absolutely. Now let's get back to Ephesians. Children obey, this is chapter 6, children obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honour your father and mother, this is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. I was just saying to someone how putting these three together, I didn't intend to talk mostly about unconditional love, and it just leapt out of everything. It just keeps leaping up all the time. It's fitting together. It's been astonishing and awesome. And here again, nurture, love, nurture and admonition, love and discipline. Isn't that an area where we parents feel often so uncertain. Should we punish? How much love are we giving? How should we punish? How should we discipline? Are we giving enough? What do I do about this child who misbehaves? So I thought today we will concentrate on the same thing, love and discipline, and then on the other area which plagues and causes a lot of anguish, puzzlement, discouragement in parents, and that is how to share your faith with your children. Now it's interesting, you may have noted, you know, so often we keep getting the sort of idea that it's a mother's major responsibility to bring up the family, it's father's major responsibility to work and toil. Here, it's fathers that are addressed. It's assumed that they have a very important major role in home making and child rearing. No suggestion here that they're out there. Fathers are absolutely vital for child rearing. And it's very interesting what it says. We won't discuss what it says to the children. The children aren't here. We'll just look at for a moment what the fathers are told to do. Do not provoke your children to wrath. Now, doesn't that happen often? How often does father come in with a heavy hand, not understanding all that's been going on? Haven't you seen it happen so often as a mother? Now, why do they fall into this trap so often? These days, probably because of the nature of their work, they see so much less of their children than the mothers. They're in danger of knowing their children less, of listening to them less. In fact, a recent study showed that Australian fathers spend 3 minutes a day with their adolescent children. I know one of my daughters came home from 12th grade a couple of years ago, very upset and disturbed, and said they'd been talking about families in their 12th grade class, and she was the only one who didn't say wistfully and sadly, "I hardly ever see much of my father." It's a modern agony. And sadly, the role that fathers are often given is the authority role, a sort of hand-to-bottom role, the policeman role. And often they're relating to their children more in the area of discipline than in love. And they're so often then in danger of being unjust because they don't know enough about the background, they don't know enough about the child, they haven't listened enough, and they're apt to race in. Now that doesn't always happen, but if the child feels they're not very important to the father and they see little of him and are not nurtured in a loving relationship, they're likely to resent very much that the major type of relationship is disciplinary. And the Bible is hitting right there. Now, some of your Bibles will use the word parents instead of fathers, and that's fair enough, because very often in the Bible the male word is used to include the female. And certainly for this occasion we will take bringing up children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, or in love and discipline, as a responsibility for both the mother and the father. Now, I'm going to be quite unapologetic about the fact that for the next portion of time, I'm going to talk a lot about what this book says. And if you get the book and you read it again, fine, it'll stick in a bit the more likely to stick it if you've heard some of it once. I cannot improve on what this book says. It is so helpful. This is a book written by a psychiatrist who is a father. He's also a Christian. Why should we be told how to love our child? Because we're very often poor at showing it. And very, you know, very penetrating studies have shown that children often doubt that they're genuinely, unconditionally loved. We're not very good at showing our love. We think we are, but they don't get the message. I've read very, very interesting comment. Children are excellent observers, but poor interpreters. And they often don't feel loved. Now, you might say, all right, we've been talking about unconditional love applied to our husbands and other people. And maybe, you know, you're going to talk about unconditional love being shown to our children. But this is different. This relationship is much more complicated, because it's all very well saying accept them, affirm them, build them up, appreciate them, make them feel loved and precious. But you also have to train them to be civilized beings. And that's the trickiest job in the world. It's the trickiest relationship. It's this terrible problem, challenge of loving and affirming on one hand, and somehow also having to not just accept, but train. Now, how on earth do you hold those two together? This is where parents get so disheartened and muddled, and they feel helpless often. Is discipline the same as punishment? See, often we confuse love with permissiveness. So, you know, if you give them too much love, that means you're being permissive. Now, permissiveness is certainly not giving love. Permissiveness is tolerating misbehaviour or ignoring it, and we'll talk about that later. So the common problem is that parents love their children and a child may not feel loved. Now, there's been a very helpful study and a book written recently by Stella Chess and Alexander Thomas called Temperament Behaviour Disorders in Children. And it explains why some children are easier to bring up than others, why some children are more lovable and easier to handle, why in one family with the same parents you have such different situations. And they've proved scientifically that it's not only the home environment but the personal temperament of the child that is a factor. You might say, well, I knew that. I didn't have to read it. Sort of study to tell me that. Of course I know that. But there are a lot of other things that we need to think about. Parents tend so often to blame themselves almost totally for how their children turn out. And often professionals who help them infer the same. And it is an agony to say to yourself, how much am I responsible for damaging my child? And parents usually mean so well, and we all make mistakes. But it's important to know that some children are harder to get on with. Basically, they're born that way. Some children are less lovable. And they did a very fascinating study on various characteristics which make children harder to love. And therefore, it affects the mother's and the parent's attitude to them. Now, if you see this chart, we have easy babies and difficult babies. Now, by that I mean basically born easy babies and difficult babies. And we have nurturing mothers and non-nurturing mothers, so that you see that The best situation is an easy baby with a nurturing mother. The worst situation is a difficult baby with a non-nurturing mother. I don't know whether you, what your experience is. I feel very much that I'm right in here. I had two difficult babies out of five. And the trouble is that you can't just put yourself in a box and say, well, I was a nurturing mother, so that was all right. It's not as simple as that. Because when you have a difficult child, whether he's intense, whether he's very competitive, all the different characteristics that make him more into a prickly porcupine instead of a purring kitten, you as a parent react to that porcupine or kitten. And you probably mishandle a child, you don't give the same amount of loving, accepting, unconditional love, unless you're a superwoman. And so they don't get the nurturing that they desperately need, and it's a vicious cycle. Because you have the kind of parenting, whether a child is easy or difficult, the frustrated parent, the parent reacting to the child and making their parenting less effective. And it goes round and round. Now, the comforting thing is that if a parent can give love in that situation, it can affect the temperament of the child to a certain extent. So you have hope for the child, and that the most important thing in all that equation is whether you're a nurturing mother. Now, who is a nurturing mother? A nurturing mother is a mother who wants the child and is capable of providing a loving atmosphere where the child is loved and accepted. A non-nurturing mother is someone who consciously or unconsciously rejects the child, is not capable of giving an atmosphere of love and acceptance. Back again to love. Now, I had, as I say, two of these, and one of them right at the beginning. And I stumbled on trying to be a nurturing mother, and it was very difficult. And what happens is that your love tends to become conditional. Unless you can understand something of what we're talking about today, it's almost inevitable that this child who's always doing the wrong thing will receive from you exasperation and anger, frustration and rejection without perhaps you even realising it. And here was I, someone who'd done years of paediatrics, so I was supposed to be an expert, a Christian, full of all sorts of ideas about rearing children. And I had what I call a bed flinger. That is, I got so discouraged about handling this difficult child that I would fling myself on my bed and weep time and time and time again and say to myself, why is X little, this X next door got easy children? Why have I got this difficult one? To compound matters, the next child was one of those model childs who did everything right. And my mother said to me once, you know, if you'd only had him, you would have been so smart. You would have thought it was all due to your wonderful child-rearing principles. So it's very important to understand there are some difficult children. And you've got company, any of you who are suffering this life. Now, despite all my efforts, we continue to have trouble. And this wonderful Christian woman I mentioned, Mary, when I went to her in desperation when my child was 14, I said, what can I do? And she said, I think that child sounds as if he doesn't feel loved.
and just hit me like a fist in the forehead. Me, a doctor, a pediatrician, a Christian, my child didn't feel loved. But it can so easily happen. This is why I feel so very strongly about this situation. And also, it's never too late to start again. Now, I didn't have this book to help me. I was stumbling along. But at least I knew that I had to show love to that child in some way. And when you start in a difficult situation, not in the beginning when they're tiny, to give you some idea of how some things are out of your control. This child, when his brother was born, was walking and talking. And he was only 18 months old. And although he bent over backwards to prevent any tension or jealousy, he stopped walking and he stopped talking. And he didn't talk till he was 3. And he used to go back to crawling and would race in front of his brother with a toss of his head and just say, "See, I can do it better than you." But it shows how sensitive children are at such an early age. Now, what was I to do? It's much harder when you're in a situation where you have a child who doesn't feel loved through your mishandling, through circumstances of life, through the fact that they're difficult. Two things I did which really helped and may help you. I tried to make the most of the lulls when he wasn't doing the wrong thing. They weren't very often. I grabbed them, tried to show appreciation, tried to do anything to somehow praise that child and make him feel appreciated. And here I was really following the scripture. I'd really been exploring what love means in the Bible, in the New Testament, and I discovered this, that it was a way of appreciation. Because often with these children, you sometimes feel you don't even like them. And mothers can feel very guilty. I sometimes hate my child. They bury it. They feel terrible. But with some of these difficult children, they're not lovable. But you see, the gospel doesn't leave us without help here. You can go ahead in the way of appreciation, even when your heart feels empty. So I built up appreciation. I built up bridges of communication, bridges of common interest with this child. What could we do together, just he and I, that we both enjoyed? And I found that he liked World War II books, so did I. So I combed the second-hand bookstore for World War II books, and when there was a good one, I'd say, "Hey, look what I've got." Or I'd look through the TV programs and find a World War II movie, and there was quite a few on at that stage. Why don't you and I watch this movie tonight? So it's very important. These are two things you can always do, no matter how bad the situation is. Now that relationship from that point started to turn around, and now we have a very deep, appreciative, warm relationship. And not only that, but out of his own suffering, he has learned compassion. This is what I think is the wonderful thing about what the Lord does for us. He can take our mistakes and somehow, if we offer them up to him, bring some special fruit out of that. And this child had the sensitivity to others in pain and the compassion that he'd never had if he hadn't suffered. So take heart. If you offer these mistakes to the Lord, in his own time, he can bring very special fruit out of it. So the foundation of a solid foundation with our child is unconditional love. And we are confident that a child can be correctly disciplined only if is given unconditional love. Without that, it is not possible to understand the child or his behaviour or how to deal with his misbehaviour. And this is the basic message of this afternoon. You cannot discipline a child adequately unless he knows he has unconditional love. And so much of a child's misbehavior is because he doesn't feel loved. Now, that's not the only problem, but it is so much of it. What is unconditional love? Loving a child no matter what. No matter what she looks like, what her assets and liabilities and handicaps, what we expect her to be or how she acts. It doesn't mean we'll always like her behaviour, but we reject the deed and not the doer. Now, this is another thing that I found so helpful in my struggles, to try and keep that in mind. It was such a simple thing. Reject the deed but not the doer. And it puts it in focus straight away. And so often we say, you are a naughty girl, not, I don't like that. I love you, but not that. How often do we see our children through their faults? It can become an unconscious habit. So easy. We look at them, we see their faults. That's how we see them. Now, unconditional love is an idea we'll never achieve, but we can go in that direction. We've learned from session one the direction to go. We've learned what unconditional love is. And we have to remember that much of children's behaviour is unpleasant. It's normal. If we can give them unconditional love, they will begin to feel comfortable with themselves, they will develop self-esteem, and they'll learn to control their anxieties. If we don't, if we give them conditional love, which most of us do, we approve of you if you're good, we disapprove of you if you're naughty. We give you love if you're good, we withdraw it if you're naughty. We do it again and again and again. And it's so damaging, not only to the child in his own self-esteem. He feels incompetent. He believes it's fruitless to do his best because he's never satisfied. He develops insecurity and anxiety. No self-esteem. Not only that, we're teaching him conditional love, and that's how he thinks about love, and then that affects his attitude to God, and also it makes him much more difficult in his relations to other people. Now, Ross put this in a very vivid way, which I think is marvellous. He says each child has an emotional tank. He said, this is figurative but very real. Each child has certain emotional needs. And when they're met, his tank is full. And when they're not met, his tank is empty. And this affects how he feels and how he behaves. The fuller the tank, the more positive the feeling, the better behaviour. Only if his emotional tank is full can a child be at his best or do his best. And who keeps his emotional tank full? His parents. That is absolutely vital, and that's our first job. I didn't see it so clearly until I read this book. It throws such light on so many things that have happened in my family, and I hope it will throw such light on so many things that can happen and have happened in yours. A child's behaviour usually indicates the state of his emotional tank. So how do we keep his emotional tank full? Now in 1 John 3:18 it says, dear children, let us not love with word and tongue, but with actions and in truth. And a child is much more affected by our actions than our words, and we often don't realise that. We're not very good at showing love. Now, how do you convey love to a child?
Campbell talks about four areas: eye contact, physical contact, focused attention, and discipline. Four ways of conveying love. Eye contact, physical contact, focused attention, and discipline. Eye contact. You know, we don't think about that. But primarily, it is one of the most important ways of conveying love, especially to children. They feed their emotional tank from eye contact. Have you ever tried to have a conversation with someone who keeps looking in other directions? You know, you get the feeling somehow that there's disinterest and indifference, and so you're not interested in that person. And yet we as parents often have fallen into a number of traps with eye contact with our children. We have warm eye contact under certain conditions, that is, if they perform well and bring pride to their parents. It's conditional. Or, even worse, we sometimes use solid eye contact negatively when we want to convey instructions, anger, reprimand, strong eye contact. And sometimes, even worse still, we use avoidance of eye contact as a punishment. Haven't you often done that? Your child has done something wrong, you don't look at him for 2 or 3 hours sometimes. And the psychologists and psychiatrists say that this sort of thing is more damaging, more hurtful to a child than corporal punishment. Now, we are models too for our children. And if we don't use eye contact primarily for showing love and falling to these traps, it may affect them in their ability to relate to others, and they may not develop good eye contact either. And I've seen children like this, and they find it very difficult to make friends and relate to people. In fact, they did a study on a pediatric ward in America, and they noticed and really examined the fact that the nurses in a pediatric ward tended to go more to certain children than others when they were in different rooms, and they examined those children. And they found one of the big factors was that some children didn't have good eye contact and people didn't like them. They hungered for love, but they conveyed an attitude of indifference and dislike, not meaning to. Now, if we're models to our children, what are we doing to them? So I think, you know, let's think about eye contact, physical contact. The study showed that most parents touch their children only when necessity indicates. Now you say, oh no, that can't be true. We assume we're doing it when in fact we seldom do. And when I read this, I sort of reflected on my own attitudes to my children. And I realised that with one of them, I had much more physical contact than the others. She was a lovable one. She was easy. She was reaching out. She had no problem. And I realised too that I'd been brought up in a family where there's very little physical contact. And I'd subconsciously followed on. And it's enormously important. It doesn't just doesn't mean hugging and kissing. It means an arm on a shoulder, a friendly pat, a tousle of the hair, a little hug. It's very interesting. Reflecting just now, I was hearing of another psychologist's study where they said that actually all human beings need love and affirmation so much that we need about 12 hugs a day to really fill our emotional tanks. So, you know, how much we need deliberately to really do something in this area. And it's something we can do. But this book is so good, it really helps you, gives you things you can do right away You can improve your eye contact. You can improve your physical contact. Now, I must say, strangely enough, even though I feel I followed my parents' habits as far as the children were concerned, I didn't with my husband. We were very demonstrative in front of the children, always had a lot of hugging and so forth going around, and I think this is terribly important. And it just has astonished me over the years how, when you know, couples are going together and they're engaged and they're very demonstrative around anybody, and then in the home or with married couples, you hardly see anything much in public. Now, our children need to see us demonstrating love to our spouse. And you don't wait till he does it to you. You do it to him. What he does is not your responsibility. What you do is your responsibility. And it's marvellous for children to see love demonstrated to them, between their parents. Vital. We must convey our love to our children before anything else. Before teaching, before guidance, before example, before discipline. 3, focused attention. Now this is hard. Because it requires time. It means full, undivided attention. And it's terribly important to a child because it makes him feel valuable. A child should be made to feel that he is the only one of his kind. Let me read you something that really hit me about this and was a great help to me. Delight in them openly, your children. Speak your praise of them. Look at them with the widest eyes you can imagine and don't be ashamed to be seen at wonder. You will not see their like again. What a shame if they should leave without ever knowing they have been beheld and offered up by an astonished heart. Is that our attitude to our children? Are we afraid we'll spoil them? We do far more harm by little love than too much. And if it's the right kind, it can never be too much. So parents need to set aside time. One parent, one child. And you know, we tend not to do this often. We tend to be all together. And you have the sibling rivalry and the competition and demands on parents' attention, and it can be good, but one parent, one child should be a very high priority. And we should get together with our husband and try and work out how each of us can do this in different ways with our children. Focused attention is the most powerful means of keeping their emotional tank full and investing in their future. Are we too tired to nurture our children? Now, one of the greatest traps on mothers is this. They get up fairly early, they get the kids off and the parents and husband off to school. They work all day. And by about 4 o'clock, when the kids are starting to come home, they have the dregs of their energy and love and strength to give to their family. And that's the most important time of the day, between 4 o'clock and 10 o'clock at night. So as a doctor, I've seen this happen so often, I say, if you don't have a rest in the daytime, feel guilty. You've got to have energy and enthusiasm, if possible, to give to your children and your husband. And it's your responsibility to make sure that you don't neglect that. Now you might say, when are we getting to discipline? Isn't that, you know, more important? Well, I hope the message has got home that discipline isn't the most important. does discipline mean punishment? Now, love and discipline, Campbell says, cannot be separated. And punishment is a very small part of discipline. And making a child feel loved is the first and most important part of good discipline. Now, I know this. As soon as I turned the direction around with my own child, and with the second difficult one, as soon as I concentrate on what I see now is filling their emotional tanks, the misbehaviour is less and less. Now, it still happens because they're difficult children, and we have to deal with it. Permissiveness is ignoring or tolerating misbehaviour. Discipline is trying to train towards good behaviour, which is more effective than punishing for bad. But sometimes you have to deal with situations. But it is not fair to discipline and punish a child whose emotional tanks are empty. What is discipline? It's what I said before, training him to be a civilized being in this world, training a child in mind and character to become a self-controlled member of society. Discipline is immeasurably easy when a child feels unconditionally loved. Now, I don't know, care how many times I say that in different ways. He wants to identify with his parents if he feels loved and valued. He's then able to accept his parents' guidance without hostility and obstructiveness, usually. But if a child does not feel genuinely loved and accepted, he has real difficulty in accepting his parents' values and attitudes. Without a strong, healthy love bond, the child reacts often to parental guidance with anger, hostility, resentment. The more we keep his emotional tank full, the more he will respond to discipline. The less we keep it full, the less he'll respond to discipline. Part of focused attention is focused listening. And a child, if he feels his parents do not understand because they haven't listened, feels great resentment. It is so important to listen. It's so easy not to. It's so easy to jump in anger. And the emotional reactions of parents are one of their biggest problems, you know. I have a niece who said, "I thought I was a good Christian woman until I had children. And my word, did I learn something about myself? Anger, fury, frustration, self-pity, all those things can be stirred up by trying to handle children." It's very important to apologise. The parents feel they should never apologise. It's vital to apologise if you've been unjust and you find out. And to watch your vulnerability to overreacting emotionally. If you're sick, if you're fatigued, if you know it, you're much more vulnerable. When a child misbehaves, what does one do? I think it's very important to have the long range view. You need to deal with it, but you need to ask the question, are his emotional tanks empty or they full? Is he sick, tired or upset? In other words, what does the child need? Now, we won't spend any more time on discipline. I'm hoping that you'll read this book where there's more details and it gives you more light. Really Love Your Child by Dr. Ross Campbell. Victor Books. And you can ask down in the bookstore how to order it, but I think you could order it at any bookstore, any Christian bookstore. Now, I just want to spend a little time on a rather intriguing experience I had. I thought, it's all very well talking about families. Why don't we consult the victims? And so my husband and I, before a seminar, we said, oh, let's ask the children what they think. Let's ask them what they think about families and how families should work and what's important. What is important to make a good family? That was scary. We have children who are rather forthright and honest, and they would say what they think. I didn't know what I was going to come up with. It was very fascinating to get the ideas from this was from a 9-year-old to a 24-year-old at this stage. And you're very interested in what they said. First thing they said was atmosphere. Where there's warmth and love and acceptance and fun and a place you want to return to. And a happy childhood is something you remember all your life. Atmosphere. Love and acceptance. Two. You won't believe it, what they said. It's vitally important for a child to feel loved and accepted as he is. That's what they said. Before I ever came across this book. All of them. Then they said discipline. Yes, it's important to have a framework of rules in a family. But they'd like to know why. They'd like to have family discussions. They'd like to understand their parents' values and why they wanted things that they wanted. Be fair. Listen to us so you know what's going on. Apologise if you find that you haven't known. Respect the privacy and mood when they're upset. Have family conferences. Reject the deed but not the doer, said my 9-year-old. She picked up a bit of jargon, but she latched onto it. She knew what it meant. In other words, don't always say, I am naughty, but what I do is naughty. Don't reject me. And the adolescent said, patience, acceptance and love and willingness to listen. Please put up with our rantings and ravings and our emotional eruptions. We won't always be like this. And then they said, home is the best place for a child to be naughty. What do they mean by that? I think that meant the same thing as the friend of mine who'd been away, very thoughtful, humorous friend, father. He said, it's lovely to be home where I can be my own grouchy self. In other words, maybe our expectations as Christians, we always have harmony, are quite unrealistic. There'll be all sorts of things going on. There'll be eruptions. There'll be the whole pain of children learning to share when they don't want to. There'll be fatigue and there'll be emotional turmoil and it won't always be harmonious. But to expect that and to accept it and to make a place where people are accepted as they are doesn't mean that you can allow Johnny to damage Daisy. Doesn't mean that you don't prevent misbehaviour. But basically they know that you love them as they are. And finally, they talked about what it meant to be a Christian family and our whole yearning and desire to share our Christian faith. And you know, we thought a lot about this. And we thought how easy it is to fall into the trap of sort of expecting Christian families to be identified by
certain things they do, going to church, having family prayers, teaching them to read the Bible, praying with them at the bedside at night, a few things like that. And we put great store on that. And if our efforts in those areas are not successful, it makes us feel very inadequate. It's very interesting to hear what the kids said. They said, all those things we've talked about are the most important. To be accepted and loved is terribly important as part of the Christian family. And it reminded me of a very thoughtful comment by a very thoughtful man amongst a group of people that were talking about their backgrounds and how they were from Christian families. And what was it about their family that instead of making them react against Christianity and give it all away, it had a positive effect? And one of them said, I think the most important thing in our family was that we had fun together. That was what he put. In other words, in his mind, the Christian faith was integrated with positive, fun, love, fellowship. Not do's and don'ts, which it so often is. I recall a very dear friend of mine who did all the right thing, as we think of it, emphasised all those things we talked about, had a large family, and one of her daughters rebelled and went away. Later on, she wrote to her mother and she said that she at last discovered that Christianity was a joyous response to a loving father. And she said, that isn't what I found at home. It was just demands, demands, demands. And my friend wept and said, how could we have done it a better way? And it's very interesting that the children said what is vitally as important is that the parents be Christian themselves. And that they didn't push religion down their children's throats. They all said that. Don't push religion down your children's throats. Overkill by well-meaning parents. Don't push religion down our throats. But if you are enthusiastic, and if you have ideals, and if to you Christianity is an exciting adventure, that rubs off on us. They said, church? Oh yes, and it was amusing. My rebel, who I'd had a great deal of trouble with in his adolescence, said, oh, church is okay. Kids usually don't mind going, though maybe in adolescence they don't like it. It's probably important to go to church as a family. That's not where the action is. They said, family devotions? We're a bit divided about that. I said, oh, find your own style. Be ready to change if it doesn't fit. That's not where the action is either. They said, let their parents be ready to respond and listen to anything we ask. Never be shocked at what we ask. Listen to our doubts and queries. And don't feel pressured to evangelize us. Respond to our need. Don't pressure us. And they said, it's important to expose children to Christians, other Christians. Have them in your home. Let's see what people who love the Lord look like, act like. If we see, meet people whose love draws us, that's important. And they said, have plenty of books around. Christian books, fascinating books, and tapes and music. And share your faith with us, and share your problems with us, and share your growth with us, in honesty. That's where the action is. Now I'll have to stop. Perhaps I'll just stop with one more thing.
just something from this book, Parents in Pain, which also is a must. Don't brood over your failures. Yes, your weaknesses may have harmed your children, just as your parents' weaknesses harmed you. But brooding over the damage you've inflicted on your children will help nobody, least of all your children. It is good to recognise your faults and bring them honestly to God and your children. But then leave it at that. Don't dwell on your weaknesses and failures. Don't cripple yourself with futile remorse. And I'll finish with this. There's a difference between repentance and remorse. Repentance is saying, I'm sorry. Repentance is recognising where you're going wrong. Repentance is sharing it with God, asking his help and rising up to go on in hope again. Remorse is not forgiving yourself and not believing that God forgives you, and you can wallow in it and think it is right. That's not on. Brooding also dishonours God. It is not mourning before him, but shutting him out of your pain.
We could continue listening for a lot longer, but we did say we'd finish off with some questions, and we do have a few questions that have been put into the question box, and we're going to ask Dr. Lois Anderson these questions now, and then perhaps if anyone has some questions and would like to ask from the floor. The first one, Colette Dowling in the Cinderella Complex states that women like to be dependent on their husbands, but how independent should the Christian woman be?
Now, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. I'll be honest with you. I'll share what I can and say I don't know, or this hasn't been a problem. I'll think about it. This is a very penetrating question. And I think it reminds me of something I had wanted to say. Christian marriage, to my mind, is almost like a triangle, with God there, woman there, man there. And one other radical thing which the Bible teaches is that marriage is not your highest priority. Your relationship to God is more important. Now that, in a way, frees you somewhat from some of the stereotypes that we've been sort of frozen into since the Industrial Revolution, where a woman is supposed to be in the home and a man is supposed to be the breadwinner. And inside in that often has been that a woman finds her satisfaction through a man, a husband, and in some cases almost loses her identity through her husband. Now in the Christian teaching that isn't on. Because although you're one flesh with your husband, you also have a certain independence. And this, how independent should the Christian woman be? Your first priority and your prior growth is with God. So in a way, you grow as an individual, and yet you also are building a new one flesh identity with your husband. And this is fascinating, very rich. So there's a certain amount of independence and there's a certain amount of unity. Now, as far as dependence, I haven't read the Cinderella Complex yet. I've got it here to read next. But I think there is some probable deep meaning that rises from basic deep situations over the centuries where a woman is the child bearer. and as such she must be dependent on the protection of her husband. And I think that's had deep psychological and emotional impact that's ingrained in our society even now. So that there is, I think, a sense of peace or contentment or joy when a woman is married to a man who assumes a certain kind of responsibility to the family unit that is expressed in the love we talked about. But I think he does have a special sense of responsibility that's a little bit different from how a woman looks at marriage. And I pick this up very fascinating when you have young men about to be married and you notice their attitudes to marriage in comparison with your young daughter's attitude to marriage. And the difference, very interesting. And the males do seem to have a greater sort of sense of responsibility that is not threatening, that is a great gift to a woman. And this is how I've felt it in our family. So you have these two dimensions, very complex, very fascinating. I can talk a lot more about that, but I bet it is.
The next question is, feminists like Jessie Bernard think mothering is fine, but since it is not a job that gives financial return outside the home, employment is seen as a more desirable role. What are your thoughts on mothers being paid for their work at home?
I think it'd be great. I can't see how the economy would stand it though, frankly. I think that she's putting her finger on one of our problems here. I don't know what we can do about it, in that we're so pay packet oriented that we still tend to judge our significance by monetary return. And if we were paid for homemaking, I think that we would all feel better. I certainly would. I think we'd be magnificent. But how that, I mean, I think we'll have to do without it, because, you know, financially, how on earth any economy in this day and age and economic climate could afford it. It would say to us that our job is as significant as our husband's job. Now, that is true. And as I said before, it is vital for you to work that through with your God and, if possible, with your husband. And as you feel, other people will catch on. And it would underline that very much if it was recognised in such a way. But I can't see it as a practicality.
The next question. Women do seem to be more expressive, etc. How much of this is a biological influence?
A very intriguing question, very controversial at the moment. In other words, are there feminine and are there masculine characteristics? Are they basic? Are they hormonal? Or are they just produced by our cultural expectations, in that we've been reared so that men are supposed to be not emotional, not show their emotions, not cry, supposed to be tough, and women are supposed to be tender and emotional and sensitive? Well, certainly Jesus wept, and he was very sensitive to other people's pain. So he doesn't fit into this sort of cultural mould.
I think that there's been a great deal of damage, especially to men in our society, by the expectations that are thrust upon them so early. The little boys aren't supposed to cry. And it's very difficult to know what to do as mothers. There is much more freedom now. At least they're not putting such fierce boxes. They can do more things together, and the things that girls do and boys do and the things that girls play with and boys play with aren't so rigidly boxed up as they used to. But what do we do? I really haven't thought about this. What do we do in training our sons? What do we do in training our daughters? I certainly know from observation and listening over a lot of years that women tend to perhaps be more sensitive to other people's feelings on the whole. I mean, generalisations are dangerous. People vary right across the board. You have some insensitive women and you have some sensitive men. But at the moment, there seems to be more women who are more can express their emotions and are sensitive to other people's feelings than men. Now, whether this is deeply ingrained and innate, or whether it is the result of the expectations of our society, or whether it is a mixture of both, I don't think at the moment we can be dogmatic about. I think that a lot of work will be increasingly done in this. What do we do about it practically? I think that we, as women, really try more and more to be expressive and affirming, and that we help our men to gradually overcome all the constrictions that society has placed upon them. And the interesting thing is they say that if you reach out in love and openness, 90 times out of 100 times, you will get a response. And I think this is the way we must go, to help our husbands and our sons be open and expressive and open themselves. We can do that more and more. It will enable them more than anything else to gradually come along this road.
Do we have anyone who would like to ask Dr. Lois Anderson a question? He books on the subject you've just been speaking about.
Yes. The books by John Powell are more helpful and more clear and more detailed than any I have read in helping people to open up themselves and therefore helping our husbands to open themselves up. Particularly The Secret of Staying in Love and Fully Human, Fully Alive, but any of his books really help you to find out and to experiment in the how of this.
Is there anyone else? Have about 5 minutes, and maybe Dr. Lois Anderson would just like to finish off with some more thoughts during that time.
Friend Mary said to me once, "Our children are given to us for our education." And I thought of that when I was listening over the ABC recently and read in the paper one of the studies about child couples, with the conclusion that child couples were on the whole happier than those who had children. And I thought, what do you mean by happy? And how long have you been married and had no children? And how many samples did you take? And what do you know about what happens to parents
when they have children. Children change our life drastically, and they crash into our desires for comfort and ease. And if you equate happiness with comfort and ease, then fine. If you don't have any children, you'll probably have it easier and have it more comfortable for a while. But what does being a parent, what does it do to us? What does God teach us in our children? He works through them to make us people we would never dream we would be. For instance, teaches us humility. We're brought to face, as my niece was, with her terrible limitations. You may say, who wants that? We learn of our inability to keep our temper, to understand and to guide and to do all the things that we hoped we would do. But we learn a lot about ourselves, and that's the beginning of growth, and that's the beginning of healing. And again, our self-centeredness is battered, and we learn compassion, and we learn patience, and we learn to be sensitive to people in pain in a way that I find to be very difficult in any other way. Now, some of you may say, oh, that's all very well, but that's not fair if you don't have children. Does that mean that people who have children are far ahead of those who don't? Well, it's an interesting question to ask, because my friend Mary was childless. And she said she was regarded by some women as not being a proper woman because she hadn't had children. But this was her assignment from God, and she had to work it through with him. And she was a teacher. She said, I realised that my pupils were my children. And she learnt all those things from reacting with her pupils to become a very effective person. You may say, well, there you are, there's your answer. If you choose to be childless, you'll manage, you know. But if you choose to be childless because you want to be comfortable, that's one thing. If childlessness is your assignment from God and you offer it to him as a way of growth and walk with him, that's another thing. Encouragement. We grow and we find we're able to do things that we perhaps wouldn't have thought possible. We're given so many gifts through our failures. We learn so much. As Keith Miller said in Habitation of Dragons in his first chapter, which I'll never forget, failure is often the only bridge I have with hurting men and women who are dying for their images of success. And there's nothing like a hurting parent to be sensitive to some other parent in pain. But we may reject God's gifts of our children, reject humility, and remain selfish all our lives. You can do that. You can wallow in self-pity and rejection. You can resent the sacrifice of time and effort and money. You can demand repayment of your children all their lives long. And some people do that. Don't be one of them. Or you can always feel inadequate. You can take total responsibility for how your children turn out and wallow in guilt and remorse. Now, when it comes down to it, none of us is good enough. And we'll all make mistakes. And we'll keep on making mistakes. But I hope today at least we've found all sorts of directions that we can take. And in the ultimate, and this is where this book of John White's is so helpful, you cannot take the responsibility for another human being. You can offer what you have to God and to them, But in the ultimate, they are responsible for their own choices. The thing to do is to offer them up to God and to know that He loves them more than we do. And He will care for them and will always yearn after them and lure them if we water those things with our prayers.
I'm sure that you would want me, on behalf of all of you, to say a special thank you to Dr. Lars Anderson for coming and sharing with us today, for all the preparation that she has put into this seminar. I'm sure that each one of us, as we go, won't be the same women as we were when we came into the Sydney Temple here today, because I'm sure the Lord has spoken to each one of us. And He will help us to be the women in our family situations, the women that He wants us to be. I would like to thank all those people who helped to make this seminar such a wonderful day. A lot of people who worked behind the scenes.